You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today.
Why? Why is it that way?
We begin our countdown of the top physics breakthroughs of 2016.
It's a little bit more like an art than it is like pure math. And that's what's amazing about it.
As chosen by quantum physicist Ian Durham.
This tying the knots in rope was their written language. That's how they did it, and they would tell stories this way. And it's, you could kind of think of it as being a little bit similar to that.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to a special edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Today, we're celebrating the greatest advances in physics over the past year. As usual, I'm joined by quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, who's picked out his favourite stories of 2016. You know, a lot of things happened in 2016 in general. It's not been one of the best years.
No, it has not.
It's been kind of horrible in many ways, but hopefully, by looking at physics and science, we can, you know, look at some of the nicer things that happened during the year.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I actually had considered doing a little surprise thing and making one of my five something to do with, something to bring attention to some of the issues that were happening in 2016. And I said, yeah, we'll just go with the usual one and hope that maybe it distracts people from the rest of the stuff.
Yeah, the misery.
The misery, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so as usual, we will start off with some things that, you know, that didn't quite make your list, and you can explain why. So, you know, what sort of things were you looking at this year that were good but didn't quite make it?
Okay, so the first one literally came out, what's today? Today is the 22nd.
It is.
This came out 3 days ago, so that's why it didn't make the list. It might have not made the list. I'm not sure. I would have had to think about it, but it certainly is one of those things that would be right on the edge. It just was very last minute. Basically, so some scientists at CERN in Switzerland have made some measurements of an actual antimatter atom for the first time. It's antihydrogen. They basically found that antihydrogen and hydrogen have pretty much the same properties, which is kind of interesting if you think about it.
So before you tell us why that's interesting, just remind us what antimatter is and what sort of things, I guess, people want to know about it.
So what is antimatter? A lot of science fiction treats antimatter as something bizarre and unusual, and actually it's really not that bizarre. So if you take an anti-electron, an anti-electron is a positron. We call it a positron. And a positron is just an electron with a positive electrical charge as opposed to a negative one. Now, technically, antimatter is a little bit more complicated than that. In fact, there are other what we call quantum numbers. So electrical charge is a quantum number. And there are other ones that are internal quantum numbers. So spin is not an internal one. But there are other ones that are internal quantum numbers. And antimatter always has the opposite sign for the internal quantum numbers that the matter counterpart has. But it's just another particle out there. There's nothing really unusual about it. What's unusual and what has always bothered physicists, rightly so, is the fact that there seems to be an awful lot more matter in the universe than there is antimatter. And that's a curious phenomenon. Now, it's actually a good thing, because when a piece of matter and a piece of antimatter collide, they annihilate one another and leave a photon or leave some energy there. So if there was an exact balance, then there probably wouldn't be anything here because everything would have just annihilated. But we wouldn't be here having this conversation. Nevertheless, it's a little odd. Why does the universe have more matter than it does antimatter? So in that sense, we've been trying to understand antimatter more.
So, you know, let's just talk a little bit about how they managed to make this. You know, I'm looking at an article in Nature by Davide Castelvecchi, and he talks about how CERN's Alpha Collaboration managed to make antihydrogen back in 2010. Mm-hmm. And the way they do this is that every 15 minutes or so, they produce about 25,000 antihydrogen atoms. And they do this by combining the positrons you were talking about, so the kind of anti-electrons that are emitted by radioactive substance, with antiprotons that are produced in the particle accelerator. But the difficult part of this, so they did that back in 2010, the difficult part in terms of making measurements is to slow them down, cool them down, so I guess you can kind of look at them closely.
Mm-hmm. They're using an optical trap is what they're doing, which is a very common technique, but it's kind of unusual, I suppose, to use it on, well, I shouldn't say it's unusual. Even physicists get hyped up by this by thinking, oh, it's kind of unusual that we're using it on antimatter. Well, if you really believe the fact that antimatter ought to behave just like more matter, then maybe it's not that bizarre. If you can create the antimatter, there's no reason you can't use a typical optical trap to hold it in place, which is essentially using lasers to kind of stabilize it.
And so is the difficulty because the antimatter is going to annihilate with matter so easily, so you're having to kind of find a way to trap it without letting it annihilate with its kind of opposite particle?
Yes. Yeah. So hydrogen, of course, is the most common element in the universe. It's everywhere. It's one of those things where, you know, if you want to create antihydrogen, you got to make sure there's no hydrogen floating around anywhere because you'll lose any antihydrogen if you do. But I think as long as you can produce more antihydrogen than you've got hydrogen, just as long as you've got enough antihydrogen that you can then play around with it with the lasers. Because lasers, of course, use light. And light, photons are sort of their own antiparticle. So they should interact the same with hydrogen as with antihydrogen. And so there's no danger of doing anything to the antihydrogen with photons. So if you can get some antihydrogen in an evacuated box and then use the lasers to stabilize it, it should, in theory, work exactly the way that stabilizing hydrogen in an optical trap should work.
And so let's talk a bit about the measurement they did and the result they got and why that is interesting.
They actually measured a whole slew of things. So,
well, the one that I'm looking at is measuring the frequency of light needed to kind of move to the next energy level.
So in hydrogen, so if you take hydrogen, it consists of one proton and one electron. There are no neutrons in most hydrogen. There are isotopes that have it. So what happens is the electron, there's a ground state energy. So there's a lowest energy level that the electron can be in. When you put energy, and this is the core of quantum mechanics, it was discovered, and this goes back to before Heisenberg and Schrodinger and stuff, Bohr was modeling this. But the idea is that the electron cannot take any value of energy, it can only absorb discrete values of energy. So it can absorb certain wavelengths of light, but not others. And so if it absorbs the right wavelength, then the electron takes that energy in and gets knocked up to a higher energy level. But it can only take certain discrete values of this. And those discrete values are very, very specific. This is the basis of atomic clocks, in fact, measuring the frequency of transitions in certain elements. And, of course, atomic clocks are the most accurate clocks we know. So the idea with the hydrogen and antihydrogen would be to see, are the energy levels the same? And are the photon energies that are allowed to be absorbed by hydrogen the same as those that are allowed to be absorbed by antihydrogen? And according to the Alpha Project, the answer is yes. So it's the same energy level patterns.
Okay, so I guess this doesn't really then solve the mystery of why there's less antimatter than matter. It kind of just extends it.
It does. In fact, I think it's funny. It's a fascinating result. It's great. But it just makes the puzzle more confounding because why? Why is it that way? I think I would have been happier had they found a difference because then I would have said, oh, it seems easier to try to explain an anomalous result than it is to explain the lack of a result, right? We have no explanation for why there's less of something than there is of something else. But anyway, It's been 3 days, and I got a lot of thinking to do about this one, so...
I don't want to keep you on this one for too long because it didn't even make your list.
Yep.
But you did send me an interesting article from CBC News. And I just wanted to point out one little thing that was on the end of this article by Nicole Mortigliaro, where she talks about the possibility of antimatter galaxies. And so I just wanted to bring that in because it sounds so exciting. And she's talking about how the Alpha team, the Alpha experiment, will be, you know, one of their next steps is to study the gravitational forces on anti-hydrogen and to see if it is the same as we would expect for hydrogen or if there's some kind of anti-gravity effect, in which case, I guess, the antimatter would be flying away from matter and could be collecting into sort of galaxies of their own out there, which is just such a lovely image. I thought I'd throw that in before we move on.
It's also a load of bull.
Oh. Okay.
Here's
Well, you sent me the article, Ian.
I know, I sent you the article, but here's my take on that. The one thing that's not different for matter and antimatter is that they both have positive mass, and positive mass should behave the same under gravity. So if I had a 10 kilogram chunk of hydrogen and I had a 10 kilogram chunk of antihydrogen, they're both 10 kilogram. The way Einstein's relativity is derived, and even the way Newtonian gravity is derived, there's nothing in there that says anything about the difference in internal quantum numbers. I think it's kind of ridiculous to think that it would behave any differently than regular matter. And especially if you think of how general relativity works, it's mass is what warps space-time. You can't define a negative one in general relativity. So that's why I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say. I think that's sensationalist to say that.
Well, now you've shattered my dreams and hopes of discovering an antimatter galaxy.
I know. I'm sorry.
Let's move on to something else that didn't make your list.
I'm not saying there won't be an antimatter galaxy. I'm just saying that the chances are extremely low.
Okay.
We'd have to completely change some of the ways we think about relativity and stuff. And I'm sure there are people who say, oh, then let's do that. And I say, yeah, but that relativity works. So anyway, but we'll move on.
Moving on, yeah. What else didn't make your list?
So the only other one that didn't make my list that I wanted to talk about briefly was AlphaGo, which was a computer program developed by Google's DeepMind. It was designed to play the board game Go, and in March of 2016, it beat one of the world's best Go players in the world in a 5-game match. And it was the first time a computer Go program had beaten what's called a 9-Dan professional without handicaps. So that's a ranking in the Go world. And what's significant about this is that Go is vastly more complex. So chess is, of course, often viewed as the prototypical example of deep learning kind of thing. You know, back in the 90s, Deep Blue had beaten, God, what's his face? Russian guy.
Yeah, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, anyway. isn't he in the Russian parliament now, I think, or something like that? Anyway.
Gary Kasparov,
thank you. No, he's not in the Russian parliament. He's in the opposition, I think. Anyway, chess is extremely, extremely complex, but Go is even more so, by orders of magnitude. In combinatorial game theory, Go is what's called a zero-sum, perfect information, partisan, deterministic strategy game. So that's in the same class as chess, checkers, and Othello, but it's far more complex than these. I mean, far more complex than these. And so, as a result, getting a computer to win at Go is like taking computers to a level that's way beyond what anything in chess could do. Your really good chess players can typically think a few moves ahead and can map out all the possible combinations for a few moves on both sides because the combinatorics are still not quite that bad. You can't do that with Go. And so Go, as some Go players have said, it's a little bit more like an art than it is like pure math. And that's what's amazing about it, because a lot of these really top Go players have an element of feel to their game. Like, they're not just crunching numbers in their head or, you know, thinking through specific strategies. They're actually working through a feeling almost, almost an aesthetic kind of feeling. And that's really interesting because you now have a computer that can do that, which is unusual.
So I was just reading up on this in an article in phys.org, and they've quoted this guy extensively. I guess he's an expert in IT from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. His name is Fai Yu Wang, and he's written an editorial in the IEEE/CAA Journal of Automatica Sinica.
Okay.
Just, you know, just rolls off your tongue there.
Yeah.
But he has loads of really nice quotes. I kind of sort of just wanted to read some of them out because, you know, he's talking about this marking a new era in AI, and he's talking about parallel intelligence. So his point here is he's sort of saying, well, you know, the reason AlphaGo was victorious is because it played more than 30 million games itself and kind of learned from all of them. So this is more games than any one human being who's like 100 years old could play in their entire lifetime. And the computer's kind of learning from each of these games. But he says the human player wasn't defeated by a computer program, but by all the humans standing behind the program, combined with the significant cyber-physical information inside it. And he says, this also verifies the belief of many AI experts that intelligence must emerge from the process of computing and interacting. And he talks about this kind of parallel intelligence, which is this kind of hybrid, and, you know, and then he goes on to say, AI is not artificial anymore. Ultimately, it becomes the real intelligence that can be embodied into machines, artifacts, and our societies. So it's just very eloquent, and so I thought
No, that's great. And I think I saw something on the internet recently, which of course is always dangerous, where somebody was talking about how they thought that predominant intelligence in the universe was largely artificial, like, or what they would call AI. I don't really quite know what they meant by that. But I would agree, it has really interesting implications for the emergence of intelligence and what it says about how intelligence emerges. So, yeah, in the end, the computer is just a piece of machinery that's been programmed by a bunch of people. But it's been programmed by a bunch of people, and if it produces a certain level of intelligence, then to some extent, intelligence is some kind of an emergent property, which is really interesting. And I would say that there's probably evidence for that to begin with in the biological chain of evolutionary ladder or whatever. I think there's some evidence for that. But, you know, this would be very interesting because it would add an element to that and would change the way we looked at intelligence.
Actually, that's quite an impressive one not to have made your list. So that bodes well for the rest of the list.
I'll tell you, the reason that didn't make the list is I wasn't sure if it was physics-y enough.
Yeah.
That's the only reason it didn't make the list. You know, so I debated on that because it certainly is a huge deal.
Well, now we're on to your top five, and I guess number five is physics-y enough. So please go ahead, reveal what it is.
Okay, drum roll, please. My number five is that physicists this year successfully tied the very first quantum knot. And before I go into the details of this, I just also want to throw a shout out there to one of the two lead physicists on this, David Hall, who's at a liberal arts college, Amherst College, here in the U.S. So I'm at a liberal arts college, in fact, not far from Amherst. And so it's great to see liberal arts people making big discoveries. So what is it that David Hall and his partner, Mikko Mutunen, if I said that right, there are lots of umlauts, who is of Aalto University in Finland, what did they do? So for a long time, specifically quantum field theorists, have predicted that you should be able to form knots in quantum fields. Literally a knot like you would tie, but it's not quite the same thing because the dimensionality is a little bit different. But anyway, no one ever really knew how to do that, though. What Hall and Mutunen did is they were able to tie knots in a superfluid by manipulating the magnetic fields. And it's really hard to kind of visualize these things, but they're like loops in quantum fields that are all connected to one another exactly once. That's kind of the way to look at it. And that's what they did. It's a little bit like a pretzel.
So it's obviously something that's very, very difficult to do experimentally. So I was reading through another article that you sent me, this time from Gizmodo by Jennifer Wallet. I hope that I've pronounced her surname correctly there. I know her, so it'll be very embarrassing if I haven't.
I know, I was going to say, we both know her. I've never actually used her last name when talking to her, so I don't.
Hopefully she will correct us if that was incorrect. Yeah, but she wrote this lovely article in Gizmodo, and one detail that, and it's got a lot of technical details about how they did this, but one thing that kind of jumped out at me that really made me smile was that because it's so easy to kind of disrupt the experiment after it's been set up, the people who were in the room weren't even allowed to take bathroom breaks, mm-hmm. So which turned out to be a little bit painful for some of them, but I thought that was a nice little detail there.
Which is why I'm not an experimentalist. I like my bathroom. I got to put in just a little side note here that at the Newton Institute at Cambridge, they have whiteboards in the bathrooms. You never know when you're going to be hit.
Okay. Well, that's not as bad as, I guess, having toilets in the lab itself. So
That's true. Anyway, so...
This has taken a strange turn, so let's go back to the physics side of it. And what can we kind of do with this? Are there any kind of applications to this? Or is it just something that's sort of fun to have done and maybe one day we'll find applications for it? Or do people have something in mind here?
No, actually, this has potential implications for my field, quantum information. Maternin thinks that the work might provide a good basic proof of principle for doing some topological quantum computing. So in a design like this, they would basically braid qubits, so which are little quantum bits, into kind of knot, and different kinds of braids would encode different computational tasks. And those structures would be topologically stable. That's kind of interesting because you could move these things around and it wouldn't really introduce errors. One of the major problems in realistic quantum computing is the thing about qubits is that they're very sensitive to their environment, and you can get decoherence. And moving them just a little bit, you can lose some information that way. Whereas if you could code up the information in the braids of how you braided these qubits together, so you've got knots, and you're tying knots to knots to knots to knots, and each unique set of knots would encode something different. That's very robust against moving it around. You could take that string of braided qubits and just move it around. And it wouldn't, in theory, there shouldn't be a whole lot of decoherence from that. So there's a lot of topological stability. The one way you could think of this is, if any of our listeners is familiar with the way the ancient Incans used to write stories, they didn't have necessarily a written language. They actually tied knots in rope, and this tying the knots in rope was their written language. That's how they did it, and they would tell stories this way. And you could kind of think of it as being a little bit similar to that.
Oh, that's so lovely. I almost don't want to say the next bit because now it sort of, I don't know, it's hard to follow that lovely Incan story, but... But you were talking about this topological stability, but I guess, you know, another thing that's discussed in this article is that even mm-hmm. though these knots are topologically stable, they might not be dynamically stable. So the topologically stable part kind of corresponds to the fact that you can't really untie the knot without doing something sort of incredibly drastic. You know, they're stable in that sense.
Correct.
But they might shrink and disappear. So I guess that's something that they'll be looking into.
Yes. So if you tie a knot, it's very stable. It's going to stay that way. It doesn't unknot itself, but the knot can shrink and just kind of vanish. While it would be stable topologically, your information could just go poof and it would be gone. And there are certainly challenges. There are challenges to everything, but there are other people who are working on this, and I think this is very promising. If they can address that dynamical issue, then it's very promising as a potential for quantum computing. I mean, just the mere fact that they did this at a liberal arts college is pretty cool. but you know, they're making, it's really cool stuff. So
tying the first quantum knots comes in at number 5 on Ian's countdown. We'll have more information about that and about the two advances that received honourable mentions on Ian's list on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. To hear what beat them all, tune in to part 2 of this special year-end podcast, which includes...
Anyone who follows FQXI will know of Garrett Lisi and his E8 theory of... it's kind of a theory of everything sort of thing. And so I actually asked Garrett about this just because I was curious. I said, well, how does this, how significant is this to your E8 theory? Garrett's response was that the new result is, he said, it's a little bit similar to the Higgs mechanism in physics in the terms of its significance.
Thanks again to Ian Durham. You can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @FQXI. I've been Zia Morali.